hour two of the People Show. Vic Nizar, Randy Janda, Jamie Dogg, currently absent right now on a mission. Eddie Gregory and A-Dog, Andy Cole, running the show today. You as well, 650-650 into the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox. The smart alternative, visit Dunbar Lumber on Bridge Street in Ladner or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at dunbarlumber.com. We have an update. Jamie Dodd has procured said ketchup popsicles.
I'm seeing the picture right now. He tweeted it out, at Jamie Dodd on Twitter. He's got it in possession. He's got one. I'm hoping he has three.
I assume he's got more.
I hope so. I hope he's got five, actually.
Yeah.
I wonder what he said. If they said, sir, one is only allowed, what did he say? I'm from the People Show. I demand you give me five.
Good poll.
Let's see. I can't wait to hear the story from Jamie. How he found it. It's like the Holy Grail. It's like his favorite movie, Indiana Jones.
Ooh.
How did he find the Frenchsicle?
Raiders of the Lost Sickle?
Raiders of the Lost Sickle. I don't know if that works.
Raiders of the Lost Dodd.
Yeah, there you go.
Like it. I like it. I, for one, am excited.
Happy birthday. There you go.
There you go. Okay, it's not done yet, though.
No.
It could melt on the way here.
That would be really unfortunate. Did we send him with, like, supplies or anything like that?
I thought there's a block of ice in our freezer. If he really wanted to do this proper, he could have taken, like, a plastic bag, buried those popsicles, like, within there. Let's see. Let's see if he did that. And why we have a block of ice in our freezer, I'm not sure.
We're not going to answer those types of questions today. We're just going to get excited for the Frenchsicle, which is en route from Jamie Dodd. I'm excited. I'm weirdly pumped up for it.
Legit. I am absolutely, you know, I've done weird stuff like this before as well. You know, the whole one chip challenge, the drinking the, you know, egg yolk and all that stuff. Remember that turkey dinner Jones soda we actually did on the People Show?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
That was interesting as well. So this is really, this is what I live for, Vic. Weird stuff like this.
Weird consumption. All right. We'll talk to Will Scouch in just a second here. Jamie Dodd will join us in just a little bit as well. But Will will connect with in just a second. Getting ready for the draft. 2 weeks away, man. 2.5 weeks away. Actually, I guess 2 weeks tomorrow. It's gotten here a lot faster than I probably anticipated.
It's kind of wild because it's one of those things like the trade deadline and like, you know, a few other things, free agency, or it's not the trade deadline, the draft and, and, you know, free agency. It just kind of creeps up on you because you're not paying attention to it so much because of the Stanley Cup final. And it's almost here. We've talked about a lot of these prospects. We're going to talk about a few more here with Will Scouch, but it's almost here.
Let's talk to Will right now, who joins us from McKean's Hockey and also scouting.ca NHL prospect analyst. Will, how's it going?
Oh, it's going all right. It's a really, really, really hot day here in Toronto. So,
love it.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, yes, it's great, but it's really hot.
Actually,
but things are good.
You had an awesome weekend. This is a pro F1 show. Randy is a massive F1 guy. You were at the Canadian GP.
I was in Montreal this weekend. It was a lot of fun. I've never been to a Formula One event, but it was a heck of a lot of fun, and I highly recommend it if anyone's considering it.
All right, well, I'm going to the French Grand Prix in a couple of weeks here in July.
Oh,
any
right.
tips for an F1 newbie just to going to a race?
Just bring rain gear. Saturday it rained a lot, and it was pretty miserable. Friday it rained after the second practice event, and that was also pretty miserable. So even if there's no rain in the forecast, you don't want to be caught without rain gear. So I highly recommend that. And at least in my experience, be prepared to stand in line for a while. We had a few lines and then another one and then another one, but we made everything in time, still had a great time. You're going to have a blast.
Okay. And also I've been told, do not buy merchandise because they sell, what, $100 per hat? Like something crazy like that?
Hat for $80. The t-shirts were, I believe, 130, and like polo shirts were 170. I believe there were a couple of raincoats you could have bought that were Aston Martin branded, and I think they were close to $500. So bring your wallet if you're going to buy stuff. But Yeah, and they certainly really want to sell you that merchandise for sure. There's a lot of kiosks, and it's enticing for sure.
That fuel don't pay for itself. It's got to pay for it somehow.
right.
All right, let's get into the NHL draft. You know, we've talked to you about a little bit about this player, and he's so polarizing. You've got him last I saw in your rankings at number two, Brad Lambert. You know, there's different views on him. And I can understand every viewpoint because there's the prototype aspect to it. How do you view it, and why are you so excited about this player?
Well, I mean, part of it, I mean, I think a lot of people accurately identified that he is one of the best young players out there right now for his age group last season. And I thought he had a really good under-18 tournament last year. And I thought, you know, obviously expectations were really high for him coming into this year, and things haven't really gone according to plan, I don't think. I track data myself by hand, and so the offensive data itself with Lambert, at least with Yaveskola, the first team he played with this year, was not great. He made the switch to Pelicans, which is a team that he used to play for a few years ago, and everything just took a nosedive. His transition results and passing results were some of the best that I've ever seen, especially for a men's league player before he made the switch. And then afterwards, he just became basically anybody else. They took him out from playing center. They moved him to the wing, really limited his options. And I felt like he was trying to force things way too much over the course of the entire season. I think the wild card with him is he going to be able to learn when to be a little more creative and when to sort of be a little more simple and just focus on executing the plays that form around him. I don't know. I still think that he's the best combination of speed and skill that you're going to find in this draft. He beats out more icings than I've seen a lot of guys in this year's draft. He will go into the corners. He'll go into the boards. You know, defensively in the defensive end, yes, there are moments where you're going, I want to see more, but usually that's because the guys around him also can't play much defense, and after 30 seconds of chasing pucks around defensively, everyone's going to look bad defensively. I'm extremely confident that things are not as bad as what people think. And guys like Brad Lambert from year to year do not forget how to play hockey. Atu Ratu last year was a guy who I heard people saying was, oh, he's a late second, early third round pick. He's not the player we thought he was. And he's moved to a new situation. They gave him first line minutes playing center, and he's been a point per game in a men's league this season, and just been a much, much better hockey player than he was last year. So I think that if you play the long game with a guy like Lambert, especially if he's a guy that you add in the early second round, if he somehow by some chance slips to that range, I think you're laughing. Even if he doesn't turn out to be a top line player, I still think there's enough raw talent there that if you play your cards right and take your time with him and sort of encourage him in the right ways and form a relationship there, I think you're going to end up with a really, really, really good hockey player.
I wanted to talk to you about some players that, you know, we haven't really talked about that might fall in the range that the Canucks are looking at. And one player that I look at is Swiss defenseman Leon Bichel, who's 6'6", 225 pounds, and plays for Leksands right now in the Swedish Hockey League. But when you look at this player, is he a player that might be in that position where the Canucks are at? And does he project as a top four blue liner for you?
I don't know about top four in terms of really driving play. I mean, I think that he could be one of these guys that he kind of reminds me of like Eric Cernak. Not a guy who is going to like win a Norris Trophy or not a guy who's going to lead your team in defensive scoring. Like he's not going to be that guy, but there's enough skill there. There's enough skating ability. There's enough physicality and size to have a really well-rounded defense first, you know, in a good way, not just a guy who hits and then doesn't know what to do with the puck when he frees up the puck. Like he's a guy who has flashes of some really good evasive skill and puck management. And he is a guy who will get more physical along the boards than a lot of defensemen eligible at this age in this draft. So if that's what you're looking for, then absolutely. I get the feeling that NHL teams will latch on to that pretty quickly in the draft. I mean, defensemen are kind of at a premium. The Vancouver Canucks will get a kick at him, I'm sure. I don't think he'll be drafted that high. I just feel like there's going to be better players on the board that Vancouver might want to add ahead of Bichel. But he's a good player. Like, he's a good defense-first guy. I just think that you have to sort of set your expectations reasonably. And if you pair him with the right player, then yeah, he could play on a second pair. But I don't think he's going to be a guy that you put on your second pair and he really drives that pair. I think he could be a nice supplement. But I think there's still a bit of a ways to go to really sort of hit that kind of upside.
I know you're not a big comp guy. The reason I bring this up is because, you know, we're here watching the Stanley Cup final and Valeri Nichushkin's just crushing it right now. And I'm more interested in the idea of like development curves, because Nichushkin's took a while to get to this stage. And hey, in hindsight, you can say it justifies his draft spot and all that sort of stuff. Well, when you try to evaluate development curves, do you incorporate that all into the evaluation of where you are right now with this prospect?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult because I'm an outsider. I think that development is something that is vital. I think it's why I feel almost every year that there's a large group of players where I could see a large number of outcomes.
Right.
And I think that one thing to keep in mind is it depends so much on what the team does behind the scenes. I know that there are NHL teams where their style of development is welcome to camp in the summer, and then a week later they give you a list of things to work on and say, all right, see you next year. Other teams will be more direct and more involved in building relationships with teams and players and really sort of staying on top of them, making sure that things are coming along the way that everybody agrees is the right way to do things. And I think with certain players, you can definitely identify, okay, here's where they're really, really strong. You know, here's where things are working and here's where things are not. And I think that you can very clearly point those things out in a tangible way, not in a non-anecdotal way. You know, it's easy to say, oh, this 5'10" scoring winger is too soft or he doesn't get physical enough, but that's not what you're drafting them for in the first place. You know, if you focus on that, you're going to be missing a lot of what makes that player potentially really special. So I think it really depends on what the team itself has in store for what that player is. But I also feel like, especially in the draft, it's really interesting to see how teams draft for what I believe is what I would consider fit. Certain teams will draft certain types of players because they know that these are the types of players that they really like to draft. Maybe that can lead you down the wrong path, but again, that comes down to development. It's what they're more comfortable with developing and what they feel like they can work with. So that also is another factor. I think about it as if I were the king of the world and I could basically say, okay, here's the player we're drafting in one document and why, and then in another document, here's my development plan. Here's what I think this player should work on and where we think the type of role that they can play in the NHL, and combining those things together in a way that lines up with how I see the player and how I see my NHL team wanting to play. Cause there's a variety of different ways that can work. You know, we see different types of NHL teams go to the Stanley Cup final every year and teams chase those types of teams. And then the next year, someone else comes along and then other teams chase that team. And it just kind of is this weird cycle. So it's a matter of like, what do you believe? What do you think can work and why? And why do you think this player fits that archetype? And where do you think the work needs to be put in order to get there? So it's very personal for me because I don't really have the best insight into how each individual team sort of handles it, because I do think that it can be quite different.
You're listening to The People Show. We're joined by Will Scouch, NHL prospect analyst. You can catch his work at scouching.ca. And one of the more intriguing young players that I've seen is, and we've heard a few people talk about him as well, is Spartak Moscow's Kirill Dolshenkov, who is 6'6". He's got hands. Obviously, this is not on the high end of the draft, but as a sleeper, what do you think of this player? Because his physical aspect is pretty, you know, impressive in terms of the size and the hands, but what do you see when you look at this player?
I mean, you kind of summed it up. I mean, he's a guy who is a giant. He's got a pretty quick wrist shot. The problem-solving skill is there. But I think with Russian junior players, you know, you got to be really careful with who they're playing against, what they're doing against that type of competition. And I mean, I've watched a lot of junior hockey in Russia over the last few years, and some teams they should be in a different league. Like, it's just a very different universe out there. And with a player like Dolzhenkov, I think he's a player who, with his physical tools as they are now, gets a lot sort of handed to him. You know, he's a really hard player to get on top of, but I look at his skating and see it as fine for a guy 6'6". But I also see him through the lens of I'm watching Russian junior hockey. And I, in that league, I've kind of learned that I really need to set my bar really, really high. especially for players that maybe don't have a tremendous amount of pace and don't consistently bring a lot of really sort of challenging offense to MHL level defenses, where I think Dolzhenkov kind of falls short there. But, you know, and look, if a team drafts him 25th overall and thinks, hey, in 7 years, we might have a giant, you know, puck possession monster, you know, maybe a Juraj Slafkovský clone, but not as good. I guess I could see that happen. I can't disagree that that's possible, but again, in the draft, it's like, what are you leaving on the board? And I feel like there's a lot more to be had with other players, and especially with all the question marks about Russian players now, and what, how different teams might value that or take that into account. It's a question mark that kind of just knocks him down my board. I've seen him a few times this year because I've heard a lot of talk about him. I really tried. Like, he's not on my final list. But I could see him being a guy that an NHL team drafts, and maybe we'll see in 5 years. But he's raw and untested against, I think, competition that could really, really challenge him. So we'll see. But if a team wants to take a risk, I would not be surprised, because there's tools there.
There's a couple of teams that have groupings of players that are draft eligible. Obviously, the United States National Team Development Program always got a cluster of guys. Moose Jaw's got a couple of guys, and Jurgarden's also got a trio there as well, waiting to be drafted this year. You know, separating the individual talent, when these guys are all grouped together, how do you go about that process in evaluating each of these guys individually?
Yeah, that's the tricky bit, right? I always sort of, when I look at my groupings, I kind of order them from, you know, I'm a bit of a riverboat gambler. I like to think about upside. I like to think about taking risk and trusting a player that really showcases something really impressive. But also, and in various different ways, with these players, it's got to be something that I can point to and goes, that's what makes this player special at the top of this group. And at the bottom of the group, it might be more, well, there's a lot of interesting bits and pieces here, but there might be some big question marks. For example, guys like Lane Hutson and Jagr Furkas are at the bottom of one of my groups. But at the top of that group is guys like Matthew Savoy, Liam Ogren, Frank Naser, where it's just there's a lot more that I'm more confident in. But if things break right for these players at the tail end, then all bets are off, and they could really outperform their draft slot. But in that same group, there are guys like Cutter Gauthier, Yuri Kulich, Connor Geeky, where I look at them and I go, I can kind of see what this guy's going to do. I can kind of see the role that these players are going to play. It's pretty clear. Maybe they overperform if development really, really goes well, but I could see something there. So it really sort of depends, but I always sort of think of, how many things are really special about this player, and how much am I concerned about hitting this sort of higher upside that I could see? And I think that that's kind of what separates things for me in these groups. But, you know, I also have to understand that I could be sitting in a room with scouts and a guy like Kevin Korchinski still on the board, or Marco Kasper, and a lot of scouts are going, yeah, but these guys are going to definitely play in the middle of our lineup. They might have room for more. They've got some good skill. They have some nice, you know, physical elements to their game. And a guy like Kasper's case, maybe there's a reason to pass on a guy like Joakim Kamel or Matthew Savoy or Liam Ogren for one of these guys. Would I want to do that? No, but I have time for that discussion. So I always think about it as, who am I entertaining in this range and why, and how much would I be willing to go to bat for these guys over other guys that they came up as a suggestion as the guy you got to pick. So It's really tough to sort of nail it down. And I've been trying, you know, I've spent a lot of time in the last week sort of finalizing my list and really trying not to nitpick, but be confident in what I'm thinking. And it's tough. But I always go back to, could this player really be playing high end minutes on my lineup? And what is the chance of that occurring? And that's kind of always where I come down. And I'm willing to sacrifice a little bit of risk in terms of really sort of going for guys that I really believe in.
Well, you mentioned a name a little bit earlier that one of our listeners had a question about it as well. Jagr Furkas, you know, what kind of player is he, and what's the ceiling there with that player?
Well, I think there's tons of upside with him. I mean, I think that he's very much, you know, I think he'll be a complementary offensive piece. He's a guy who I think, in transition and everything, he kind of gets exposed a little bit for being a little bit, you know, weak on his feet here and there. but he's really quick on his edges. He's got good skill. He's got really, really good puck vision. A really good playmaker with the puck and a really quick release, like really good offensive tools in the offensive zone. I think he should be a first round pick. I'd be surprised if he slipped out of the first round. I could draft him as high as somewhere in the teens if you really believe in that skill. And I think there's a lot to like. I just want to see him get stronger over the next few years because I feel like, you know, he needs time and space to really sort of flex the offensive tools that he's got most of the time. We'll see how that works out for him. But in terms of just a high-paced, skilled, dual-threat offensive guy that might have a bit of shortcomings around the ice and might need a bit of a supporting cast to help him out, Firkus is a great option for that.
Before we let you go, mock draft tomorrow on your page?
Yeah, so we're doing a community mock draft tomorrow night on the YouTube channel at 8 p.m. Eastern time, so that would be 5 Pacific. It's free to register. The spots are filled for now, but if anyone listening wants to register, you can check on my Twitter. You can join the reserved list because people always love to drop out day of or literally as the stream starts. So if that's something that interests you, it's a nice 3-round, hour and a half long thing where viewers get to choose players in the draft, which always goes over well and is always a lot of fun. So that's going on tomorrow night.
YouTube.com/scouching and also at scouching on Twitter. Appreciate it as always, man. We'll talk soon.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks.
That is Will Scouch, NHL draft analyst.
Always great chatting with Will. Just a lot of knowledge there. Mm-hmm. He's got intel on every single player. And I like the questions and the answers also on just thought process. You know, how do you figure out which player makes more sense? What's going on in those rooms? Obviously, the war rooms during the draft pick, you know, during the draft, and just how do you get to that pick? But we've got some questions that roll in during these interviews, whether we're talking to Will, whether we're talking to Sam Cosentino, Chris Peters, whoever it may be. Keep those questions coming. And we try to get 1 to 2 in every interview because we want to make sure that the people are represented in the interview, especially on prospects. But hit us up with those questions next time as well. We'll make sure to try to ask as many as we can.
Kristen Duncan said, didn't Brad Lambert win American Idol 1 year?
Was that Brad or Adam Lambert? I think it was Adam. Right?
Ooh, it was Adam Lambert, yeah.
Right? We know where Clay Aiken or Ruben Studdard are these days?
No idea.
Unrelated. I just randomly popped through my head.
All right. I just wanted to read one from the inbox.
Fair enough.
Mike McKenna on the way, former NHL goalie. We'll talk to him about getting pulled. A lot of people talking about Kemper shouldn't get the start for game 4. Let's talk about goalie pull etiquette with Mike McKenna on the other side. Also, Kadri could be playing tonight for game 4. From a goalie's perspective, when he knows a guy is injured, how's he playing a guy who may not shoot at all?
Also, from a goalie's perspective, Nazem Kadri gets in your grill.
Mm-hmm.
How does that change the way you play as a goalie? Hey, Vasilevsky's on a heater right now. I'm sure Kadri in his grill might have a bit of impact too.
We'll talk to Mike McKenna on the other side, and we'll try to get another update from Jamie Dodd. It feels like Carmen Sandiego. Like, where in the world is Jamie Dodd? He needs more syllables in his name to pull it off.
I think at this point he is probably in Chilliwack. The man looked lost on ground.
Rough look.
When we chatted with him earlier, he was a little lost, but we do have an update on Twitter. We do know he
tweeted us.
He does have the popsicles in hand. I just don't know where he is.
I feel like George Steinberg in Seinfeld when he's waiting for the calzones. He can smell them through the vents. Costanza's in the building. Like, we know he's obtained them.
He's got, like, it's the chase point in any movie. Remember when they have, like, the prize possession and then there's a bunch of people trying to hit him up?
Yeah.
Or trying to get a hold of him? Jamie is that guy right now with melting popsicles.
All right. We'll see where he's at on the other side here on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Security here is pretty tight.
And now Patch ready for the left circle in front. Tip play, Marchessault is stopped by Demko again.
This is Demko's.
Communities rely on weather.
Ladies and gentlemen, he's back. Jamie Dodd has entered our studios again. We're excited.
What's up?
What's going on?
Good race?
I had to book it. The last thing I wanted was those disgusting ketchup popsicles melting in my backpack.
You're not excited for this?
No, I'm not.
Well, thank you for putting in the effort, for efforting.
So they're safely in the freezer.
Okay.
I got 5. They were very accommodating. I said, can I have 5? They said, sure.
What kind of fanfare was there? Was
not
it like a
lot.
Live band? Was it like a
no.
BC Lions Street
Party? So the reason I was expecting hoopla, right?
Yeah.
It was basically just the size, one thing, the size of like a hot dog stand. One woman, very nice, staffing it. No signs, nothing. But I will say, people were, like, I could tell I was getting closer because I was passing a lot of people eating the popsicles on
right.
my way. So they were getting rid of them.
I thought you were going to say, I could tell I was getting closer because I could.
People covering their mouth.
I was passing people throwing up.
He was like, can I have five? She's like, really?
She's like, have the
yes,
whole box.
Please, take them.
Oh my God, we got a whole box back here. They're all yours.
Take this whole pallet.
All right, so we'll do the official taste test of the Frenchicles ketchup flavored popsicles.
You think our next guest would try them? He is a connoisseur of fine foods, along with Louis
DeMay. I will say no.
All right. We got to ask him. But I'm looking forward to it. I'm not going to lie.
He is Mike McKenna at Mike McKenna 56, former NHL goalie, NHL analyst at dailyfaceoff.com. Mike, how are you?
I'm good. I really want in on this food conversation. I'm really not even sure what you guys are talking about, but you're so amped up about it that to me, it just feels like it's a party, man. And I'm ready to put the green hat on and go streaking, but not get arrested or not anything illegal. Probably like maybe a little mankini or something. So
okay.
We could dive deep if we wanted to that, but there is an awful lot of hockey that's still being played. There's a game four tonight. So you guys take this any direction you want. I'm just here for the fun of it. And I can't pass up a good food conversation.
Okay. I'm steering way clear of the mankini conversation, but we do have a food conversation here. So French's mustard and ketchup, they came out with a ketchup popsicle. It's called a Frenchicle.
That sounds terrible.
Well, our producer basically went halfway across town to go get these popsicles that they're giving away today. Would you try it? We're going to do a live taste test probably in the next hour. Would you try a ketchup popsicle?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I don't want to disqualify anything. Maybe it's something I would have never expected I'd like, but that does not sound good to me at all. That sounds like pure novelty. But, you know, you guys are up in the land of ketchup chips, which I do
yeah.
appreciate. So maybe I should be open-minded to this. You try to explain ketchup chips to a red-blooded American from the cornfields, and that's a foreign concept. But you know what's even better than ketchup chips to me, guys, is all dressed.
Oh, yeah.
I absolutely love all dressed chips, and I can't find them in my hometown of St. Louis. So anybody that takes pity upon me, DM me and I'll send the address.
Ketchup chips I can have like once a year, all dressed, you know, like once a month or something like that. It's the Rolls Royce of potato chips at times.
It is. Well, and you know what it is with chips? I don't eat them a lot, but when I get a craving for them or if I can get my hands on some all dressed, that whole bag's going down. And I know I can't eat for 2 days because these non-playing hips just keep expanding. And I don't want that to continue on.
Talking to Mike McKenna, NHL analyst at dailyfaceoff.com, former NHL goalie. So the coaching process has started to make its rounds. A few hires, still a few vacancies still remain. In your mind, who has made the best coaching hire so far?
I actually think that Bruce Cassidy to Vegas makes the most sense out of all three of them that have recently happened. I guess four now, because we've seen Paul Maurice is mm-hmm. reportedly headed to the Florida Panthers today. And I want to be very clear here. I don't think any of these coaching moves are bad decisions. I respect all the coaches that have gotten a job, Pete DeBoer to Dallas, also John Tortorella to Philadelphia. But Cassidy, to me, really fits the mold of what the Vegas Golden Knights need and want in a coach. You've got someone who's gotten results, who's hungry to win, and he's not afraid of a challenge. And he's had top-end players previously. Now, the thing about Cassidy that I think really works in Vegas is that it's a veteran team. They don't have – I mean, next season they may not have a single player on an entry-level contract unless Brandon Brisson makes the team out of camp. And that's always been the knock on Cassidy, is how hard he can be on bottom six players, on younger players. Well, there's a lot of maturity in that room in Vegas in terms of – You know, you think of Stone and Pietrangelo and Martinez, and I think there's a buffer there. And I think Cassidy's probably learned from his experience in Boston. DeBoer, he'll be able to hopefully bring some structure and consistency to Dallas. That's what they've missed there the past couple seasons. They've really ridden the wave, so I like that pick. And I think Tortorella is going to be the litmus test for the players in Philadelphia. This is probably Chuck Fletcher's last stab and last hire being the GM there. He needed to get it right. And you bring in like someone like Tortorella, who's got a track record of getting the most out of his teams and making people work. To me, that's going to be Ivan Provorov, Travis Konecny. Can they keep pace with what John Tortorella wants? Chuck Fletcher's going to find out real quickly whether it's the players or the coaching staff that have been letting him down over the last year and a half.
Because it's very interesting. It's not necessarily about, hey, who got the best coach? It's where are you in your franchise timeline and, you know, who is the best fit? And me personally, like, I really like that Torts Philly fit for me just because I, you know, he can be a teacher for a team that needs to grow a little bit. And, you know, very demanding also for a team that probably needs that little bit of a spark as well.
I totally agree with you. I wrote that in a piece on Daily Faceoff how, you know, Tortorella to me is he's demanding. But the players that buy into John Tortorella's systems and work ethic, they get the most out of it. You know, and I look at Cam Atkinson, who's in Philadelphia now. He had his best years playing under John Tortorella with the Columbus Blue Jackets. And, you know, I'd actually be surprised if Chuck Fletcher didn't at least seek out Cam Atkinson during the hiring process to see, you know, do you think this might be a fit for us? So in that sense, I really like that one as well. The Paul Maurice one kind of surprised me, though, guys. Like, that was kind of out of left field. I thought Andrew Burnett did a good job. And, if, you know, runner-up in the Jack Adams voting for Coach of the Year, and he gets shoved aside for a 25-year veteran in Paul Maurice. That kind of caught me out. You know, that's a pretty big swing from Bill Zito, despite a second-round exit this year where the power play just simply wasn't there. He cleaned house with assistant coaches except Tuomo Ruutu, and now here you are with Paul Maurice. So, interesting. Like I say, caught me out. Paul Maurice is a great coach, great communicator, but I expected Andrew Burnett to get another opportunity to go a full season in Florida.
Yeah, I do wonder about that because you look at that and you say, all right, clearly the Florida Panthers were saying, it's not time to experiment. We want somebody with experience. And it was a moment where, you know, Brunette in the post-series press conference admitted, I actually appreciated the honesty where he said, yeah, I'm going to be thinking all summer about how I couldn't fix the power play or we couldn't improve the power play. I actually thought that is a rare moment of honesty of a coach saying, yeah, that's on me. I'm the coach. I have to motivate these guys. I have to game plan. But it feels like the Panthers are saying, now is go time. We need somebody who's been there, done that before.
Yeah, and I think part of that is that, listen, if you're Paul Maurice and you're sitting at your cottage, you've made plenty of money in this game, but you're only 55 years old despite coaching for the last 25 years in the National Hockey League. I thought it really was going to take a lot to get him off the couch and coaching again. And I don't mean that in a negative way. It just, it felt like his time as a head coach in Winnipeg had run its course. He stepped down. It, you know, I read between the lines with that is this just somebody who needs a bit of time off. So maybe half of a season did that for him. But the biggest factor is that the Florida Panthers won the President's Trophy. They're stocked full of talent. They're going to be able to run it back with quite a bit of that talent next season as well. And it's just an opportunity that's too good to pass up. You know, he's not going to an outpost either here, guys. He's going to South Florida. Like, he can go look at gators in the Everglades. He can go snorkel in the ocean, you know, do whatever you want in season and have a good time doing it and potentially win a Stanley Cup because that's the only thing that's missing from his resume. So I think that probably played a big factor for Paul Maurice.
I do want to get into game four here in just a second, but going back to game three of the Stanley Cup final, what stood out to you of why Tampa was able to rebound so swiftly?
For me, Tampa did a really good job of adjusting to what Colorado had done in games one and two in Denver, in that Colorado was really good about playing on top of Tampa's defensemen, forcing them hard, not allowing clean breakouts. And, you know, as a coaching staff, you have to look at ways to beat a forecheck that's crushing you. And some coaches are better at adapting than others, and some players are as well. It takes both sides of the coin, coaches and players, being willing to change. And Tampa basically went to the nuclear option, flip it out of the zone. Because if there was anything Colorado wasn't doing well in the first couple games of the series, and they didn't do it well against St. Louis either in a previous round with Jordan Binnington in net, is that they keep dumping pucks into areas that Andrei Vasilevskiy can get to. And one quick pass to the D, flip it out of the zone, go down ice. That's what Tampa did in Game 3, and it really worked. It pushed Colorado back. It kept them on their heels a little bit. Now, I'm sure Colorado's going to have a tactical answer for it. That's Jared Bednar's job. But that worked. But more than anything, guys, like, Tampa was just harder to play against. They owned middle ice. They owned the boards. It looked like they really fed off the energy of being home in Amalie Arena. And it shouldn't be a surprise. We saw the same thing in the Rangers series. So, for sure, if you're Tampa, you're looking to do more of that. Strong first period, forecheck hard, and continue to make adjustments as the game progresses.
So you mentioned Jared Bednar there. And back in 2013-2014 with Springfield, you were on that team where he was an assistant coach. And I've heard, you know, a lot of conversation about him and how he's kind of navigated the AHL world and the NHL world, a lot of growth from the coach. But going back to those days, being on the staff with Brad Larson when he was coaching that team, you know, what have you seen from Bednar from then to now? Because he's got a heck of a job. He's done a heck of a job. But, you know, it feels like the Cup champs are coming now. This is where coaches really have to game plan and really have to show their championship pedigree.
I am a huge fan of Jared Bednar on and off the ice. Had a great relationship with him and the staff in Springfield when I played there. Nolan Pratt as well was one of our assistant coaches who's also on the staff with the Colorado Avalanche. Ironically enough, Pratt actually was there before Bednar. It took Bednar winning a Calder Cup with the Lake Erie Monsters of the American Hockey League.
I think they're the Barons.
They were the Lake Erie Monsters in Cleveland. But that was his catalyst. Now, Bednar had been a head coach in Peoria previously in the American League. I missed him there by a season. His players loved him. A regime change probably forced him out there, and he had to take a step back. But Jared Bednar's won at the ECHL level. He's won at the American League level. And I think his growth as a coach in the NHL has been there. And, you know, I see him being true to his roots. He doesn't give away his lineup. He's not going to tell you his starting goalie. Loves to play poker that way. But behind closed doors, Bednar is a phenomenal communicator. He's honest with his players. And you know what, guys? He likes to have fun here and there. And what I mean by that is that there's times in practice where, you know, he'll chuck a flat brim hat on and get out there with the guys and kind of be able to snap the puck around a little bit. And you see the smile come out. And that's something that players really enjoy and respect playing for. So that's the human element to Jared Bednar. I think he's a great tactical coach and he's surrounded by good people. But that's the type of intangibles that you don't really get unless you're in the locker room, and it's a reason why people want to play for him.
He was put to a decision in Game 3 that you wrote about, pulling your goalie, when is the right or wrong time to do it. And especially, you know, in the regular season, I can't imagine there's this much thought put into it. But in a series, hey, like each decision matters for a coach here. That decision to make that pull and then his decision to go into Game 4, you know, what goes into that? You wrote about the coach-goalie relationship. Is that the primary thing that what that decision comes down to?
It can be. You know, it's different for Jared Bednar than it is for John Cooper. You know, for John Cooper, it's automatic. Andrei Vasilevskiy's playing. That's it. And he's going to play the whole game. It's easy. He doesn't even have to think about it, you know? And I'm listening to people try to gin up a goalie controversy after Game 2, after Vasilevskiy had kind of struggled. And there was no question in mind who was playing. It wasn't going to be Brian Elliott in Game 3. Now, for Jared Bednar, it is different. It's really based on eye test because you look at Kemper in Game 1 and 2, and he was good. He was fine, especially, geez, Game 2, it was probably the easiest game of his career, guys, you know? But in Game 3, he wasn't sharp. He was on his knees early. He got beat on a couple of net drives where he lost his goalie courage. He just didn't have it. And I think for Bednar, knowing that he's got Pavel Francouz sitting in the hopper, who's 6-0 in playoffs and has also played meaningful games over the past couple of years for the Avalanche, it's an easy decision to pull Kemper when he doesn't have it. You don't want him to sit out there and suddenly allow 8, 7, 8 goals when, frankly, he's unproven in playoffs. You're trying to save your goaltender for the next night. And that's what I think Bednar was doing. Kemper was in the starting goaltender's crease in today's game. He didn't say that he's starting, but Kemper's starting. You heard it here first. I don't know that for sure. I'm just saying it. It's everything lines up to it. So, you know, for Bednar, I think it's traditional management. It's eye test. And again, it's communicating. I'm sure he went right to Darcy Kemper after the game or during the game and told him what his thoughts were and what the plan was moving forward. And there's a lot of value in that for goaltenders.
You know, there's been a lot of intrigue in this series. One of the most interesting things, though, has been Braden Point, where he came back in the series, clearly nowhere near 100%. And for the coach to say, yeah, you're not going to play because, hey, unfortunately, you're looking hurt out there, which is rare for a very skilled player, a star player. And I applaud it because sometimes we'll have guys out there at 50% or whatever it may be. But does that speak to the Colorado Avalanche just being so fast where if you can't match that speed or compete, there's no point being on the ice?
Yeah, and I don't think that Point was particularly slow. We still saw glimpses of his speed and what he can do with the puck. But this is something that we really don't have the insight to at what level Braden Point is playing at. You know, is he 60%? Is he 70%? There comes a moment that you have to just look at yourself in the mirror and say, man, I don't think I'm helping the team very much. And I don't think Point was bad, but I want Point in my top two lines. And I want him in the middle in the power play. And I want him engaged and explosive and able to carry the puck. And I didn't see as much of that in the first couple games. And you always wonder with an injury like he's sustained that's lower body, has there been any regression? Has the injury gotten worse? Because that happens. You know, you can easily make it worse. So I think for Point, boy, you'd sure love to have him in the lineup. But there's enough weapons with Tampa Bay, and the way they play, it's pretty interchangeable with their talent. So I would think if it's game 6 or 7 and Point feels like he can go, maybe we'd see him. But, you know, look at the other side. The Avalanche are missing Burakovsky and Girard. So it's just the nature of playoffs. Nobody's going to be running at 100% when you're going to lift the Stanley Cup.
We're seeing it on the other side as well. Mike McKenna joining us here from DailyFaceoff.com, NHL analyst and former NHL goalie. On the other side, Nazem Kadri potentially coming back here. Now, look, we know he's got the thumb issue. When you know he's on the ice, it's one thing for a player to, you know, hey, poke at the thumb or something like that. You're in net. You're in the crease. Did you ever let a player's injury status change how you play him, knowing he might not be able to shoot or anything like that?
That's a fascinating question, one I've never been asked. So thank you for coming up with a great question. You know, I never did. It never really entered my mind because I didn't play that many players that I knew were really ailing. And I think you see things in playoffs that you wouldn't in the regular season. I never played any Stanley Cup playoff games. I played some Calder Cup playoff games, quite a few in the American League. But injuries aren't disclosed and they're not as public at the minor league level as they are at the national. I think you have to look at Kadri if he's playing this evening. Let's say Kadri's on a 2-on-1 rush against. Mm-hmm. I think you have to take it at face value because you'd be surprised, first off, how hard people can still shoot the puck with injured hands. It's amazing me. It amazes me the times I've been on the ice with players that are rehabbing, how hard they can still shoot the puck. But it's not always about the strength of the shot. It's about the placement. And from close range, anybody can score, even if it's a 75-mile-an-hour muffin, if it's placed well. So I think if you're Vasilevskiy, you really have to take it at face value for Kadri. You have to know he's probably looking to defer to passing the puck. But then again, if the strength's not there in the hand, he's not going to be as strong doing that either. So it's a great question. It's something that, you know, people that have played those meaningful Stanley Cup playoff games would have a better answer for than myself. But if I were in net, I think I'd be taking it just like I would any other day.
It's probably the thing I want to keep an eye on tonight if he's in the lineup, just how he mm-hmm. manages the puck and how Tampa Bay plays him. It's going to be exciting. Is there something you're looking out for tonight, just one particular matchup?
Yeah, I'd really like to see how Arturi Lehkonen comes back after a pretty tough game in 3. And that's uncommon for him. He's been a barometer, I think, for the Colorado Avalanche in terms of, you know, plus-minus defensive hockey. He's been so strong. And if Kadri's in the lineup, I want to see how the matchups are. You know, playing in Tampa, I think that was an advantage for them, especially with Kadri out of the lineup, because then you slot in Sturm. Helm's playing in the third slot on the third line, and he's done really well in the fourth. So that's one thing. The other thing is I think that if you're Colorado, you got to stay out of the box. Even if Tampa goes 1-for-6 on the power play, 5-on-5 hockey is the strength of Colorado right now. And if I'm them, there's a real focus on keeping it between the lines, not letting Pat Maroon and Corey Perry drive you crazy on the ice.
Should be a fun one tonight. We appreciate it. And next time we talk to you, series might be all over.
Can you believe that? I hope so in some ways, but in others I don't, because I love talking hockey with you guys. So until next week, thanks for having me.
Excellent. And we'll also save you a popsicle as well. Ketchup flavor.
Yeah, we'll see Hyphen Belts on the way here to St. Louis. I don't know about that.
Appreciate it, Mike.
Anytime.
That's Mike McKenna at Mike McKenna 56, former NHL goalie, NHL analyst at dailyfaceoff.com. Interesting stuff. I do like that idea of player-goalie relationship playing into the decision of, hey, should I pull this guy, should I not?
Yeah.
Just building that trust. And when you look at it, like, yeah, okay, Cooper's been there a long time. Vasilevsky's been there a long time. They know what makes each other tick. I know it's a long season, and Bednar's got plenty of time to learn about Kemper, but that's really fascinating. Be like, hey, this is kind of new to the process between the two of us here.
Yeah, one thing that's really central to the Vasilevsky-Cooper relationship is trust. That you, yep. A, have a goalie that is always healthy, understands where their body's at, and you trust them in those situations to make the right decision. Where, listen, Vasilevsky is going to go to Hall of Fame at this rate. Darcy Kemper is not in that position. We're trying to find out a lot about him. I'm sure his coach is trying to do it. I'm sure Darcy Kemper is trying to find out a lot about himself in this moment as well. So, you know, the Vasilevsky conversation after game two, and we posed this question as well, why would you wait so long? Or why would you not pull him? Well, the classic example is because the goalie wants to stay engaged. He wants to be in the game. And that's something that clearly was the right call, because even in that previous game, I think Jen Botterill brought it up in the Hockey Night in Canada broadcast, was how intense Vasilevsky is, how focused he is, even when they're up 6-2 in a game. He wants to be engaged in that game, whether they're winning or they're losing. And that's why, you know, John Cooper is where he's at for a reason. He's one of the best coaches, if not the best coach in the league, for that reason, where he reads his room, he understands what's going on.
Vic Nizar, Randy Janda, before we go to break, we do have the taste test on the way.
Can't wait.
Frenchicles.
My Bart Scott. Can't wait.
Before we get there, though, we got to hand out some tickets for Turf Trivia. Yesterday's champion from South Surrey picking up a 4-pack of tickets to the BC Lions playing the Argos this Saturday. Tickets starting at only $25. You can go if you don't win. Lions are back and ready to roar like never before. What's the question, Randy?
Today's question, well, we were just talking about Paul Maurice. Paul Maurice has been in this game as a coach for almost 25 plus years, actually, closer to 30 now. He has made one Stanley Cup final in that time as a coach, and that was in 2002 with the Canes. Who did the Canes lose to, and who won the Conn Smythe Trophy that year? Two-pronged question. Who did they lose to, and who won the Conn Smythe Trophy?
If you know the answer, 650-650 into the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox. Got to get both right. Text it in. We'll pick a winner, give you the answer on the other side. Home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.